Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Shaughnessy, and I have my co-host, MJ DeMarco, on. And today we have Joey Santoro, who's the founder and architect of Fey Protocol. How's it going, Joey? How's it going, MJ?
Hey, Tom. Hey, MJ. Glad to be here.
Yeah, excited to dive in, guys.
Awesome. Well, Joey, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got started in crypto.
Yeah, absolutely. I got introduced to crypto in 2016 amidst all the crazy hype. I took a class on blockchain and crypto at Duke University. And I was there for the whole hype cycle, and I stuck around after. Been learning and exploring during the bear market the last couple of years, and pretty excited with how things are going right now. So, I was a software engineer at Okta for a year and a half, and been power using DeFi in the meantime. And I was looking at Empty Set Dollar, hanging around in that community, and I came up with the idea for Fey as like a alternative mechanism, better design in my opinion, and super excited to share this stablecoin with everyone.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, let's dive right into it. What are the main issues you see with other decentralized stablecoins that are around today?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing is a lot of different approaches, and I think this is phenomenal. Like, there are clear pain points and clear verticals that we want to have for stablecoins. We want to have obviously stability, we want to have liquidity, we want to have fair rewards, we might want to have collateral, we might not want to have collateral, maybe not too much, and people are trying every possible design. And I think that the popular design right now, every single one has like a critical drawback is what I'd say. So taking a look at the fiat collateralized stablecoins, obviously, they're not decentralized. They're sort of a regulatory point of failure. And I think that's obvious to DeFi, even though they're highly used. I think that if there was a better decentralized model, we would definitely pile into that one. And looking at decentralized stablecoins, I'd say DAI is a clear leader, and they've achieved something of product market fit, having an over-collateralized model. Although I would argue that DAI is particularly reliant on governance, having to manually adjust rates via governance for all the different parameters. And the over-collateralization, and specifically the reliance on debt for DAI, is a limiting factor to scale. I'm sure there would be 10 billion DAI right now if they didn't have a debt ceiling and they weren't reliant on vaults. And I see that as a fundamental problem going forward, is that have a stablecoin backed collateralization if we really want to scale DeFi in the future. And then looking at algorithmic stablecoins, obviously, the world is your oyster, like your favorite combo of parameters and one token model, two token model. And I was particularly impressed with Empty Set Dollar community. I love the people they've gotten in there. A lot of devs from the community, including myself, I was devving on Empty Set Dollar for a little while in October. And I was able to like actually code one of the proposals that helped get out of a contraction. And that was pretty powerful for me, seeing the ability of decentralization to give someone like me the opportunity to contribute in DeFi. And however, regarding the mechanism, I did feel that it sort of unfairly rewarded the senior ridge holders and the DAO. It didn't prioritize liquidity enough. And in contractions, the liquidity would all dry up and people would be stuck with these huge bags and nowhere to sell. To me, that was just a terrible experience, and it kind of incentivizes whale games. It doesn't really help the stability and the usability long-term, the way that they've designed their mechanisms. So I'm pretty excited to see what they come out with ESDV2, but I still see fundamental problems with seniorage, and Fay is not a seniorage model. And likewise with rebasing, I see there are similar issues, but Fay is a completely new approach that doesn't fit into any of these categories. And we're excited about the advantages that it has.
Awesome. It's a great overview too. And I definitely want to get more into the algorithm stablecoin competitors and what you like and don't like, but let's dive into Fay to begin with. So we have something good to go back and forth on here. What's the elevator pitch on Fay? Like, you know, how did you create it? What are the core tenets of it? And then we could go into each one throughout the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So the very first thing I want to highlight is that I see liquidity as the most important priority for a stablecoin. People don't necessarily need collateral in the sense of putting up, you know, ETH in a vault to get the ETH back. What they want to know is they want to know that when they buy the stablecoin, they can go sell it for ETH or some other asset at a very low slippage some point in the near future. And also as close to the peg as possible. And that was the intuition for Fay, is that we don't need over collateralization, nor do we need like crazy algorithms. We're just going to do kind of an exchange model. I call it liquidity collateralization. And the idea is that the protocol will sell you a stablecoin. It'll sell you Fay for ETH, and the protocol will own that ETH. We call it protocol controlled value. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that is, but essentially the protocol will take the ETH that it now owns and it will put it on Uniswap with some more Fay to create a highly liquid market for you to exchange in and out of Fay, and also denominated in fully decentralized coins. We think that that's super important, that we don't rely on USDC or anything like that for low liquidity. And there's some dynamic incentives that will maintain the liquidity on that market. And that is what keeps the peg. So we have high liquidity, high fidelity peg. And we can go into more specifics on the mechanism, but essentially the way you can think about it is liquidity collateralized and directly incentivized on the trading activity to keep the peg.
So Joey, two questions there. So the bonding curve is fixed at $1 peg. So that means that anybody can come in and arb Fay whenever they want if it goes out on one side, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the way that new Fay enters circulation is through this bonding curve that I mentioned. It starts low to bootstrap capital, but then it fixes at $1 after a certain bootstrapping target. And after that, it's always $1 or slightly above $1, depending on how governance configures the buffer. And then if it's ever higher than that on a secondary market, you can simply just go straight to the bonding curve and profit off of an ARB opportunity. What this does is it has a really great benefit that new supply goes straight to the demand. There's no centralized rewards like in a seniorage model. The new supply comes in on the bonding curve and users can go straight to the bonding curve if they want. They don't even need to go through an arbitrager. But otherwise, they would buy at a slight premium on a secondary market and arbitrage would bring it right back down. So it's a very efficient and scalable model, which is, you know, in contrast to, say, a seniorage model or an over-collateralized model.
What are the differences with the seniorage model between arbing when you're above $1? I mean, from your perspective, it's super easy. If, you know, you guys are trading at 110, I go to Fay, buy at the bonding curve at $1, I could sell in the open market and profit and bring, you know, the price back down. How efficient is that compared to the other models?
Yeah. So to me, seniorage actually has a perverse incentive kind of buried within the mechanism, which is that the seniorage holders want the price to be above $1 because they want to get more stable coins. So they will actually be incentivized to hold large bags both on and off of the DAO, if you will, or whatever the seniorage share token model is. And they will hold a lot of the tokens, the share tokens, and they'll pump the price on the market, and then they'll dump as like more, maybe possibly retail or other investors come in to capture these rewards, and they'll just rinse and repeat. It's sort of It almost incentivizes market manipulation and high volatility, which I think is not a desirable property for a stablecoin.
Yeah, and just to add to that point, you know, if you look at something like an ESD, right, the supply expansions that happen when price is above $1, that's, you know, theoretically supposed to help, you know, reduce the price on the open market. But typically what you see is, like you were saying, Joey, whales essentially accumulating more and more of the stable coin. Obviously you can let that compound to continue juicing the rewards. So, you know, that's a little direct than I think what Faye is proposing, right? You know, that stable coin expansion process, you know, that's not just going to the hands of a few early backers. That's really going to whoever wants to buy it. And, you know, the ability to expand supply is, you know, essentially as quick as you can, you know, purchase on the bonding curve rather than on Uniswap.
Yeah, that's very well said, AJ. We're really trying to build a stable coin. We're trying to build one that the incentives are, you buy it when you want stability. You don't buy it when you want to pump the price or pump your bags. And the incentives are only temporary at the beginning of the protocol, and they don't compound for the rest of time, which I think is a huge benefit to our model.
Joey, can you talk about the other side of this? Like, what happens when Faye is below a dollar? How do you get it back up to the peg?
Yeah, right. It's always easy to inflate, but it's a little harder to handle the lower half of the peg. So, so we have two really powerful mechanisms to help manage the volatility below the peg. The first is what I alluded to at the beginning. These are the direct incentives. So these kick in below the peg, not above. And what that looks like is when a trader goes to sell on the primary incentivized market, which would be Uniswap in this case, but it could be changed by governance. So we have a deep Uniswap PCV liquidity pool. PCV is, again, the protocol controlled value. So this is not ruggable. No one owns this liquidity, only the protocol. And when a trader goes to trade against this pool and they're going below the peg, what happens is they incur a burn on their balance. So they need to have an excess Faye balance, and they have to have enough to cover the burn. It's like a tax, like a dynamic spread. And this burn grows quadratically with the distance from the peg. So the further we move away, the larger the burn. So at 1%, it's a 1% burn. At 5% away from the peg, it's a 25% burn. So you're talking about like massive deflation, and this is how we get the supply back down to the level we need when there's low demand. And likewise, to return to the peg, there's a mint reward. So, and the mint reward is always lower than the burn. And this causes volatility below the peg to be deflationary, which is again expected and good for, you know, good for the stability and should stabilize the price over time.
And that contraction and, you know, essentially reward mechanism, something you could compare that to for an ESD or other seniorage model is the coupon that they buy, where, you know, you're incentivized to burn your token, and, you know, when price reverts back above a dollar, you get back your what you burned, and you know, plus an additional reward on top of that. Yours, you know, has a very similar attribute, right? It, when you sell on the way down, you know, that's deflationary. When on the way up to the peg, that's expansionary. So, you know, rather than playing the coupon game, you guys kind of approach it from a different angle, where simply transacting with the currency is influencing mechanisms.
Yeah, I would want to challenge like slightly. I think that the ESD model is almost secretly, say the seniorage model of having coupons is almost secretly inflationary. It's really like you're gambling on future expansions, and it'll only deflate if there is an expiration of the coupons, which is kind of a terrible user experience. I remember the fear of coupon expiry was so high in the one contraction that I was involved with, Empty Said Dollar, that the community was paying 30, 40% fees to these bots to redeem their coupons. And it was just a total mess. It all became minor extractable value. And I think that the Faye model is truly deflationary. This supply is just straight burned. That's it. And even though there's a mint on the way back up, the net is always a burn. And that's what's really important. And what I want to focus on is that there's a true deflation here, not, you know, not like a deferred inflation.
Joey, do you think the stablecoin or the seniorage model, when there is coupons, or sorry, when there are coupons that expire, how do they get to an efficient level of supply that's below some number if that just kills confidence in the entire system? Like, if I lose money on coupons, you know, I'm kind of like done with the system, right?
Right. I mean, that's the problem. I think, you know, there's clearly parameter tunings that might work. But to me, I think that seniorage is a difficult model for me to get behind if we want to have a decentralized stablecoin that's backing all of DeFi. And I think that an under-collateralized model like Faye or like Frax would have a much better chance at scaling to the level that DeFi needs while also having, you know, strong mechanisms that are efficient and actually support the peg.
Yeah, absolutely. When you partake in that, in the coupon game, you're naturally assuming that there's going to continue to be growth in the future. And, you know, of course, that's certainly uncertain. So there's added risk there. You know, on this point, there actually was a proposal for ESD about, and this isn't anything set in stone yet, about letting the coupons, you know, if they do expire, essentially allowing people to get back the ESD they had burned. And really the only thing they're foregoing is the added yield on top of that. So, you know, there are tinkerings and ways of adjusting the seniorage model that, you know, these groups are all trying in different ways. You know, DSD has different changes as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. But Joey, you're certainly right that Bay's direct incentive model is unique.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly unique. We're doing something very new, and I'm heavily relying on feedback from the community and from like the smartest people in the space to really tune the model and make sure we're protecting people. One of the parts of the mechanism that I'm most excited about is what happens if nobody's willing to buy back up to the peg? What happens if the mint reward is not enough? And the protocol actually does something really awesome here. It's called a reweight. And what that means is that if nobody's trading back to the peg over a certain period, the protocol will use its massive PCV liquidity to essentially bring the price back up to a dollar. Sort of like in ESD V2, they propose having a treasury that's able to purchase on the spot market to bring the price back to the peg. It'd be almost the same trade happening using the protocol controlled liquidity to bring the price back to the peg. And this is an algorithmic guarantee that happens over a predetermined window. And it produces phenomenal game theory on peg maintenance, where if somebody's really panicky and trying to go sell, they'll realize that if they sell now, they're going to have probably a big burn if we're far dislocated from the peg. But if they wait for the reweight, which is going to happen, then they'll get to sell at a much more favorable price, or they might not even want to sell in that case. So it kind of slows down any bank runs because of the burn could get pretty bad, but the reweight is coming. So people are always waiting for the reweight, and it slows down any, you know, any negative spiraling that might happen.
Yeah, and I think the reweight mechanism is really where the protocol controlled value starts to shine in terms of the benefits it can offer. Just, you know, jumping back to ESD again, you know, typically when price goes below a dollar, you see the liquidity kind of clear out because the yields for it stop being incentivized. But, you know, in Faye's situation, it's much different, right? Because the protocol controls the liquidity in the pool, you know, that's essentially stuck there. So you don't have to worry about, oh, is there going to be someone to, you know, buy this token, or, you know, can I buy it without moving up price too much, whatever side you may be viewing it from. Could you maybe talk through maybe the steps of the reweight, and then also kind of like opine on, you know, the benefits this deep liquidity brings? Because based on earlier points, right, if you want a stable coin to get, you know, really good adoption and utility, then liquidity has got to be a huge part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a four-step process. Well, I guess technically it could be five, but the way it works is, so the protocol owns a bunch of Uniswap LP tokens. The first trade it does is it converts those LP tokens back into the underlying assets. So it withdraws its liquidity. And this is all done atomically. So it takes out, in this case, it would be ETH and Fei. Now it has a bunch of ETH and Fei in its wallet. And then it looks at the spot market, and it sees if there's any remaining LP, and it takes some ETH through and purchases up to the peg price with that ETH. And now that the peg is restored, it'll take the remaining ETH and Fei and put it back in at the peg price. And then it would necessarily have some Fei left over, which it would burn. And those are the four steps. And the fifth step is that there's an incentive. It's a fixed incentive for keepers to do this when, you know, when the time period is met. And that's sort of the algorithm for reweights. And like I said, it has all these great benefits that it's guaranteed. It's a protection for holders. It really, you know, incentivizes a high fidelity peg. And it's not even a last resort backstop. It's expected that these will happen with some frequency. However, it should give a lot of confidence for investors to want to actually support the peg and take the mint incentive over letting it get all the way to a reweight. So, and then likewise, the liquidity will be so deep because of all the bonding curve funding is going to a liquidity pool that I think we'll have a much easier time integrating Fae with other protocols that can be confident in the level of liquidity that we have in Fae protocol.
Yeah, and I think this is a interesting point. Maybe, you know, we've talked about empty set dollar a lot so far during this pod, but you know, another prominent stablecoin that certainly gained a lot of steam recently is Frax. You know, Frax doesn't operate under this exact model with a liquidity pool and reweight, but it does have a, you know, essentially a collateral pool that the ratio between whether it's backed by USDC or algorithmically its other token FXS. That can vary over time as well. Any thoughts on how this compares to the Frax model, both collateralized in a sense, but differently, and both you know, with the power to kind of adjust that when fit?
Yeah, so I think Fae has a couple key benefits over Frax, but I would like to say that, well, let me put it this way: I see Frax as our most serious technical competitor. I think that the Frax's technology is the most similar to Fae's and perhaps the most compelling among all the alternatives. And I see DAI as our practical competitor, and that like DAI has captured the DeFi stablecoin market. And so we're looking at DAI in terms of like our execution and like who we're really going after, but we are looking at Frax as like another serious competitor on the technical side. And also at the end of the day, like, yeah, we can talk about all this competition and certainly I want Fae to win, but I also do think that like having a lot of different stablecoins does help diversify DeFi and helps us explore different models. So I'm really excited about all the innovation in this space. So definitely want to have a lot of winners and obviously want to maximize Fae's, you know, share in that as well. So talking more about Frax, I think Fae has some key benefits over the Frax model. One is that Frax is collateralized by other stablecoins, including USDC. So it does have, it is fundamentally, you know, tied to these technical risks of other stablecoins, especially the centralized ones, whereas the Fae model is completely decentralized. It's backed totally by decentralized assets like ETH. And likewise, Frax is using a seniorage model, a seniorage collateral hybrid model. So it inherits some of the drawbacks of seniorage models as well, like, you know, peg manipulation for rewarding the seniorage holders. And I think that I think Frax, again, has very strong tech, but I do think it still has, it sort of inherits half of the drawbacks of the collateralized model and the seniorage model, as opposed to being truly better. Whereas I think that Fae is really solving the problems of seniorage, not lessening them, likewise with over-collateralization. And yeah, the last piece that I think makes Fae a lot stronger is that protocol-controlled value is much broader than just locking up stablecoins in a vault. We can use protocol control value to do some creative things like issue a graph token denominated bonding curve where we use the graph tokens to curate our own registry for Fae protocol, our own manifest. And likewise, we could have protocol controlled value deposited on Aave, and the protocol itself could borrow against that deposit to create like a Fed funds rate or a DeFi funds rate for the Fae token on a lending platform. So the flexibility of PCV and of Fae is so much greater than Frax. And I think long-term, we're going to just have such a competitive advantage in being able to integrate in really creative ways with other protocols.
Yeah. And jumping back to, you know, different aspects of Frax that could be compared to Fae. You know, if you look at Frax, you know, that's a two-token model. You have the Frax stablecoin and FXS, which is, you know, the volatile algorithmic component. For Fae, you have the Fae stablecoin, but the other token in the model we haven't talked about yet is Tribe. You know, maybe we could, you know, go into that a little bit more, Joey, and you talk about, you know, the role Tribe plays in the ecosystem and also, you know, its potential for value accrual.
Absolutely. So we're so excited about the Tribe governance token. For one, like, it's so great that we've been able to have this entire conversation and not even talk about it. That's because Fae is a truly governance minimized system. We don't need governance. Governance is just there to support the future growth of the platform and to upgrade and integrate with other protocols. It is not required to maintain the peg, which I think is a strong benefit for, say, MakerDAO, which is heavily reliant on governance for maintaining the peg. And the Tribe token is capable of doing a couple things that are very cool. One is that it can vote on adding new bonding curves. So like I mentioned, we could add a bonding curve denominated in the graph token or in DAI, or in comp token, and we could use those comp tokens to vote on compound governance, perhaps voting Fey into compound. So you have a lot of awesome flexibility with the tribe governance token. It can tweak other parameters and incentives, and it can move PCV around. I think the strongest benefit of the tribe token, wherever the PCV is, it's probably not the best place for the next decade of DeFi, let alone or the next year, because DeFi is moving so fast. There's going to be newer and better opportunities for deploying capital, and we want to have governance able to steward that PCV and put it into the right platforms to maximally benefit the Fey ecosystem and the Fey peg. And yeah, we feel that PCV as a concept is a subset of total value locked. It's still value locked in the protocol, but it's not value that's redeemable by users. So there's no mercenary capital problem. The mercenary capital problem is that other platforms that want to incentivize TVL will be stuck doing high rewards and high incentives to keep the capital. And then once the incentives dry up, the capital will move to another protocol. With PCV, it's owned by the protocol. It's not going anywhere. And so we feel that any way to value a DeFi protocol based on TVL should be a higher multiple in a PCV model because it's a stronger use case. So that's the value of Tribe and the value of the mechanism. And we're really excited about all the potential here.
Joey, would you say that the Tribe token owns the protocol controlled value, or would that be incorrect to think through?
Honestly, it does. It really does. On a technical level, the Tribe token can vote to move protocol controlled value between addresses. And while we were debating whether to add rate limiters to this, and there's nothing stopping us from adding a rate limiter later, but we didn't want to hinder the flexibility of Tribe, at least at launch. And I think with more wisdom and more battle testing of the mechanism, we can add better safeguards. However, yes, Tribe does own the PCV, and in a sense, the security requires that the Tribe market cap, it be floored at the amount of PCV so that 51% attacks couldn't, say, drain the protocol.
And so that brings up a few interesting paths to kind of talk through. One, you know, for that to happen, right, where, you know, tribe holders vote themselves some value, whether, you know, that's more likely than not down the road further. But, you know, let's say they wanted to do that. Would there be parameters in place that would let them, you know, for example, the Fey stablecoin needs to be 100% collateralized by the value in the pool before that's even an option. You know, is that something how you're thinking about, or are you thinking about it even more open-ended than that without the constraints and the limiting factors?
Yeah, so the we've dev the protocol, it's completely open. And like I said, we didn't want to limit the usability, at least at first, while we're testing out the mechanism. And then we can actually governance in safeguards later on. And I think that the way that the governance holders is, you know, we're not going to control the protocol, right? We're just a vessel. As a dev team, we're creating this thing. We're putting it out there. It's going to be fully decentralized at launch. We're just going to be there to say, this was our intention. And the community is going to have to vote and decide on its own how to move forward. And our intention is that Tribe should never participate in direct rent extraction, because having a robust ecosystem and reinvesting PCV to support Fey will always grow the protocol more than taking a cut. And we feel that that's not what Tribe is about. And we're going to be supportive of adding rails in the future if the community sees that to be necessary. And we're going to be against any sort of rent extraction, even though it's completely technically possible.
Joey, just jumping in there on the Tribe token, how exactly will that token be released to the world? Like, do you have to stake Fey for that? Or how exactly does that get added to the wild?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of five categories that the Tribe token will fall into at launch. So the first is the one that I'm the most excited about, which is called the Genesis Group. So this is the very first group of bonding curve purchasers. There will be a period of around 2 to 3 days where everyone can pool their ETH into a contract that will, at the end of the period, go and be the very first bonding curve purchase. And this is great because it gets you the best redemption price for your Fey, so your ETH fay ratio will be the best possible. And then after that, the bonding curve will be first come, first serve until it hits the $1 peg, and it'll stay at the peg indefinitely after that. So this doesn't actually involve any governance tokens. This is just your pro rata purchase of fay. But as an additional incentive for being a part of the Genesis Group, we'll be distributing 10% of the tribe market cap pro rata to the Genesis Group. So you're getting a pro rata portion of your fay and a pro rata portion of your tribe. Totally equal opportunity to get an exposure to these governance tokens. Another 10%, and these percentages are actually not final, so don't quote me on these, but another percentage of the governance token will be deployed on Uniswap directly in the form of an initial DEX offering in a fay tribe denominated pair. So this will add additional liquidity to the tribe fay pair, where users can go purchase on the market with some of the fay they got, or if they're you know, short tribe, they could actually sell the tribe from the governance token for more fay. This will all be available directly at launch. And these liquidity shares will vest to the dev team and investors over 4 years. So it's kind of like a way to have some reward for the devs, but while having it being deployed as liquidity for users over a long period to allow for price discovery. So it's kind of a cool hybrid approach there. And the percentages again are not finalized, but we're still exploring other avenues. Another category of tribe, and also feel free to interrupt me if you want to talk about any specific category, but another avenue for earning tribe is going to be a staking pool, which a kind of a pool 2 model, where you actually take your fay and your tribe and you deploy it as liquidity on Uniswap and you stake those to earn even more tribe. And then you can reinvest your profits with more fay to like keep doubling down on the rewards. And that's just a way to have more liquidity and reward users with more tribe tokens and sort of have a way to deploy your fay tokens in the meantime before we have some key integrations. Last two are pretty straightforward. One is a community-owned treasury, which we want to have be quite large because we want to be able to distribute governance tokens directly to the users who are contributing a lot of value to the protocol. So we're going to invest in like governance delegation directly from the treasury that can vest to users so that they can get exposure to tribe. And it's not going to be capital-based. It's going to be effort-based and involvement-based because that's our intention anyway. Like, governance is going to control these, but we feel that these should go into the hands of the users who are actually powering the protocol. And the last will be an allocation, again, for the dev team so that we can steward the protocol in its early days, but it's not going to be a majority of the tokens because we don't want this to be a VC coin. We really want this to be or controlled by us. We want it to, you know, belong to the community.
Joey, so that's awesome. Just digesting that, and I'll have a follow-up question in a second. I guess my other question though for you kind of on this tangent is, how exactly do you build long-lasting confidence so that people will use fay for the long term, right? Like DAI obviously had a rough pass where we were on community calls every week debating stability fees, but everyone kind of had a sense it would be around $1. ESD, I think, is a little bit harder to make that point. And Frax has been pretty solid at $1. I just think that it takes a long time to build that confidence before people start transacting large sums of money or using it within their protocol. So it might be like months or, you know, potentially, but less likely years before people really have the confidence to pull the trigger on fay in that respect and any algo stablecoin. I guess, how do you think through building that confidence and expectations and then also getting those integrations that you need within DeFi?
So yeah, that's a great question. And we're super confident that the mechanism will speak for itself and it will facilitate a high fidelity peg similar to Frax has had. And we hope that will, you know, give us at least an easier time integrating with other platforms, and integrations are absolutely key. So we're really excited to try and like communicate and get involved with other protocols. And, you know, we have some partners who we're excited to announce later on that will be willing to integrate with us. And I think it'll be, really great for the fay ecosystem, maybe not right off the bat, but like sooner rather than later. And these will, again, be great integrations that will help support Fey utility, Fey liquidity. And we think that those are going to be key. And we're in this for the long term. As the founding team, like I said, we're not going to own the protocol, but we are going to be fighting for it and protecting it and meaningfully incentivized to make it succeed over the long run. We're going to have extremely long lockups, 4 years, for any tokens that we own, so that the community knows that we're in this for the long run. And 4 years is an eternity in DeFi. So if we haven't done anything interesting by then we're definitely not going to succeed. But we're very confident.
Yeah, and you know, touching on the utility point, that could be a tricky thing to kind of solve for, right? It's almost a chicken and the egg problem where, you know, to be useful, to have that utility, you need a large enough supply, you know, to support it. And you also need the stability for it to, you know, be used for its intended purpose. But, you know, whether it's, you know, scaling supply or maintaining, low volatility close to your peg, you know, there are different projects making different trade-offs and both have, their different advantages, right? If you look at something like ESD, you know, they're modeled is in a way that, you know, they're scaling supply fast, but it's in a much more volatile way. Whereas if you compare it to Frax, they're scaling supply much more slowly, but it's also less volatile, right? So, you know, Frax is kind of an interesting model, you know, given its uniqueness where, you know, you could see the ability to scale supply fast, but also maintain, you know, a very close price to its peg. So you kind of, you know, see it as maybe like threading that needle and, you know, both, you know, offering, you know, a scalable yet non-volatile supply right out of the gate? Or do you think Fey is something that, you know, will kind of just get better with time as confidence builds?
Yeah. So it's great that you asked this, MJ, because we have some parameters in the bonding curve that let us make these exact trade-offs, and we have not finalized the numbers for these. So, you know, we're going back and forth internally, and we're going to be opening up a lot of these discussions in the Discord, which we just opened today as of recording. So, you know, definitely hop into the Discord if you have ideas. You could check us out at Fey Protocol on Twitter, and we have links to like everything. Fey.money is the website. We'd love to have any of you in the conversation because, you know, we're not done, and we got to make sure that the parameters are tuned to have this graceful, you know, this graceful, like, we get to the right supply without too much inflation, not too explosive. And then we start integrating because we're at the right size, not too big, not too small. So it's kind of like this Goldilocks problem. And yeah, we're definitely going to be, this is the top priority conversation until we launch.
Joey, one quick question. When we're thinking about value accrual, it also, you know, makes sense to kind of appeal to people to, you know, if you can make your early adopters rich, generally you could attract a lot of attention, right? I don't think that's the goal here, but I think ESD's benefited from allowing speculators and investors to potentially make a lot of money. And I think Frax has done the same where, you know, you could stake your LP shares for numerous pairs and you could earn a yield of anywhere from 50 to 300% and you could time lock that and that gets increased with your collateralization ratio, et cetera. Do you think that your protocol will have enough value accrual by Tribe to drive that demand, or are you not relying on that like ESD is in the first place?
We're not trying to rely super heavily on the governance token as like by itself. We feel that the bonding curve and the mechanism should be enough to speak for itself. So the primary parameter that I mentioned is the scale target of the bonding curve. This is kind of like this is the point at which the bonding curve fixes at a dollar. Before that, you're just buying stable coins at a discount, sort of like coupons almost. And we think that if people are really confident in the mechanism, which I would argue that they will be, because we're really excited about the mechanism and we think it's strong. So there's bound to be enough investors who are confident in the mechanism and they'll come in on the bonding curve. They'll get us up to this scale target. And our goal for that number is that number should be the size at which we're just large enough to integrate with other platforms, but not so large that we just have a completely inflated supply. And that's the main number that we're going to be tuning to make sure it's the right fit. And we do feel that Tribe has a strong utility and a strong value proposition, and that that could be a source of you know, wealth for our users. And we're going to try and obviously drive that, but that's not strictly necessary. And we'll sort of see how it all pans out.
Awesome. And Joey, what are your biggest risks internally do you feel for the protocol? I guess on a technical or not technical level, like we already talked about building confidence and expectations, but what are the biggest concerns for you? I mean, is it adding multiple bonding curves? Is it, you know, pulling all the Uniswap liquidity and the peg reweight idea? Like, what are the biggest kind of question marks that, you know, you either really can't test until it's live or that you might be concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, this is a phenomenal question. I think until we launch, there's obviously going to be, you know, there's competitive risk. And even after we launch, there's competitive risk. And before and after we launch, there's market risk. So we're going to be using ETH, a volatile asset, as our, you know, liquidity collateral. And ETH could go down. And while because it's deployed as liquidity, we're sort of slightly protected from this volatility, kind of like the inverse of impermanent loss, where as people are selling ETH, we'll get more of it in the protocol, but it's still going to be a situation where our collateralization ratio goes down if ETH goes down. So it's possible that this will, you know, create low fidelity in the peg and people will try to sell. I think it's unclear actually to the extent that this will be the case, because the protocol is so comfortable in an under-collateralized mechanism. It it operates basically exactly like a fractional reserve bank, where we're not expecting everyone to want to redeem all at once, and there's enough liquidity for the vast majority of people to redeem. But you know, if the collateral goes down, then potentially not everybody could redeem. However, the dynamic burn incentives are there to deflate on the way down and to protect the users who might be later in the cycle. So there's these competing incentives on both sides, and there are scenarios where things could go wrong. But at the same time, we have a lot of protection and configurability through governance to slow that. So yeah, we're going to have to see how it goes. We've done some modeling internally, and you know, we've done some analysis in the white paper, which again, would love thoughts on if anyone wants to, you know, share those thoughts. And yeah, like we're doing everything we can, and there are obviously ways it could go wrong, but we're protecting against those, and we're confident in the mechanism. So we'll just have to launch it and see what happens at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, to your point, if the price of ETH goes down, that direct burn mechanism on transactions, I think will have a huge impact on, potentially mitigating that risk. But on the flip side, you know, with the protocol controlled value denominated in ETH, if ETH appreciates, that's to the benefit of tribe holders and, integrated parties that rely on the stability of the Phase stablecoin. Painting a scenario that way, you know, let's say the price of ETH doubles over the time that it's held as protocol control value. Do you see that as a situation where, you know, maybe more stablecoins get issued off of that? Or do you see that as a situation where, you know, maybe tribe holders vote themselves, some type of return of capital? You know, it's tough to know now because, of course, this is up to, you know, future participants of a decentralized community, but interested to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the world is your oyster, right? Like if we're doing great and the collateral is doing great, there's an infinite number of creative ways to inflate or return value. We're obviously going to prioritize adding new bonding curves, which fundraise assets that would be useful to the protocol. So that could be a stablecoin denominated bonding curve, obviously a decentralized stablecoin, not one that's, you know, centralized, because we don't need centralized stablecoins for stability, or even more creatively, like a graph token bonding curve or some governance token bonding curve, like a comp token bonding curve, for instance. These are the types of ways that we could inflate. Likewise, we could have like a DeFi funds rate where, you know, we're issuing an interest rate for staked Fei. I would much rather return inflationary rewards to Fei holders to have a more robust Fei ecosystem than to, you know, give rent to holders, because rent is short-sighted. And I think that there are creative ways to sort of grow the platform and grow the value prop when we're all doing great and the collateral is doing great.
Yeah, and to your point, I believe you said this elsewhere. You said it would be like, expecting a dividend out of a startup, right? You know, you that capital,
exactly,
you put that capital to work, and it continues to grow for the benefit of, you know, a company. But in this case, the Fei protocol.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to advocate strongly for that as the founders, and hope that the governance community sees it the same way.
Hey, Joey, quick question on the incentives. Like, when buyers are earning and they're earning more fame, when sellers are selling and part of their stake is getting kind of burnt or their balance, is there any ways around this? Like, could somebody make a balancer pull and kind of avoid that issue? I'm just wondering how much you can police the direct incentive side of things.
Yeah, so it's funny. I was discussing this with someone in the community, and they were saying, "Oh, what are you just going to go whack-a-mole every single DEX that offers Fei?" And we could certainly do that. It's possible for governance to add incentives to any contract. It doesn't even have to be an exchange. However, there's no way to avoid a centralized exchange if issuing Fei, and the centralized exchange would just be able to avoid these incentives. And honestly, secondary markets are great because users get all the psychological benefits of the peg maintenance without actually needing to incur the burn if they want to go sell. So we're fine with secondary markets because when these secondary markets want to get their Fei to list, they're going to have to buy it from the bonding curve and they're going to fund the PCV. So the PCV liquidity is always going to be way deeper than any secondary market. And the only way around these fees are to go to a secondary market, and the secondary markets will be a lot smaller and they'll always arbitrage with the incentivized market, which is how the peg is maintained. And we see this as a great, this is fine. There's no problems here. And there's no way to get around the incentives on Uniswap. We've taken great care when writing the code to make sure that it's impossible to avoid the incentives on the incentivized exchange.
Yeah, and that's a really important point that you brought up, right? If the Uniswap pool has, $1 billion of value sitting in it, but, it's also listed on a centralized exchange, yes, you may, face some type of burn transacting on the Uniswap pool, but, it's such deeper liquidity that, in many cases, that's probably a preferable path still. So, again, this is where, the protocol controlled value and, accumulating that over time can really benefit the utility and also maintenance of the peg.
Yeah, very well said, MJ.
Joey, one last question from my end, and this has been awesome. ESD and Frax obviously have been around for a little bit longer. I feel like every algo stablecoin has come out in the same kind of quarter, but they obviously have, hundreds of millions in supply. They have pretty solid communities. ESD might have more of a investor community. Frax might have more of a stablecoinish community, I'd say. But, are there anything those protocols could do to improve themselves to maybe box you out? Like, I think Fei is nothing short of amazing. Like, it makes so much sense to me. I guess it just keeps me up that, better tech doesn't always win. It's usually the community that wins, but their projects might not be able to be enhanced to a level that yours is at if I'm, in a perfect world. I'm just taking one side of the trade there. But I guess, how do you kind of think through communities enhancing other projects to your detriment there?
Yeah, that is certainly possible. And, we're going to expect that. We're going to come in, we're going to launch as quickly as possible. We're targeting mid-Feb, early March, and aggressively prioritizing launching over any other conversation. And yeah, we're just going to have to leave it up to the community. Like, we as the devs of Fei Protocol have very strong values, a very clear stance. We're not anonymous, and ESD is anonymous, Frax is not. We have some great people involved in the early community, and we think we're gonna be able to certainly compete. And there's gonna be competition, right? Especially given how compelling the Fei model is. There's gonna be copycats either from the incumbents or from the fast forks. So we're just gonna have to hope that the community really values what we're about and really values the innovations that we've contributed and the tech that we've contributed. We're starting from a clean slate with a better mechanism. And I think, getting rid of the baggage of these other protocols is a boon, but the existing communities and networks that ESD and Frax have are their benefits. So there, there's pros and cons on both sides. And, we're just going to get out there and do our best to really fight for the community and hope that the value we created is taken as such. And our values are that we want to look out for the non-whales. We're heavily investing in gas optimizations. We're looking at creative ways to distribute the governance token to non-capital rewarded avenues. and we're heavily invested in transparency. We're staking our public reputations on this. This is not a scam. This is not a rug. And we hope that the community will really value what we're about. And we just want to be so inclusive and transparent and secure, and hope that, that's what gets us there.
Joey, that's awesome. That makes it makes a lot of sense. And I guess my last question, and then I'll see to MJ if he has any closing thoughts here. I think it's super important that you're not an anonymous team. I think we've seen too many rug pulls with people that don't have their social status linked to the project, and, you know, leaving would obviously tarnish that. And I think that's worth more than kind of pushing the regulatory edge by being anonymous personally. How do you feel about that? Are you able to, do you think the benefits of having your face in the project outweighs what you may be able to do if you were anonymous? Would you be able to do more if you were anonymous? I guess I'm asking.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I don't tell anyone, but I considered anonymous, and I ultimately decided that both my network and having this public incentive were so much stronger. Like, I would not want to live in fear of people doxing me. I want to be fully incentivized to have this project succeed, and I want to do so in a regulatory, in an environment that could work with regulators and be widely distributed and legal and supported. And so we're looking to get people involved who are going to help with this mission. You know, I'm an American citizen, and we're going to play nice with regulators. I'm not avoiding any taxes, but we're also taking a clear stance. We're building a decentralized protocol, and we're going to give this value to the community, and the community is going to be able to do all the creative things that we might want to do as the founders, but might not be able to necessarily from a regulatory perspective. And that's just a function of decentralization. And we feel that decentralization is exactly why we're building DeFi. And that's our stance.
No, that's literally, I love to hear that. I love to hear that you're, a real person with a face and hopes and dreams and scared of things, because that's important when you're building a project. And Joey, this has been absolutely incredible. I think I speak for both of us here. I kind of love it. I love what you're building. The direct incentives make a lot of sense. Love that you're fully kind of decentralized. I kind of love how you're going through the value accrual there and kind of the longer term aspects of your thinking through the project. I think it's awesome. And where could people follow Faye and learn more and potentially get involved if they're interested?
Yeah. Thanks so much, Tom. Like, thanks for having me on here. It's such an honor. It's been an incredible ride being able to share my ideas with DeFi and Faye Protocol in particular. We're so, so excited. So you can follow the project on Twitter at Faye Protocol. You can check our landing page. It's faye.money. And you can check out the white paper, Medium article, join the Discord all through the landing page. We're really, really excited to engage with you and ship a valuable protocol very soon.
Awesome. Joey, thanks so much for coming on. And MJ, thanks for co-hosting this one. I really appreciate you having you on.
Yeah, happy to be here. And Joey, looking forward to the launch.
Yeah, thanks everyone.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.